The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, the first of which will speak on the Seventh Tradition, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the Seventh Tradition is Amanda.
Thanks. I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 30th, 2000. The Atlanta group is my home group. Stephanie's my sponsor, and I'm in steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. I want to thank Nye for asking me to speak. It's a real honor and a privilege. I love AA, and I love all of the principles because all of them, when you put them all together, it gives me a really good life. When I'm, you know, cherry-picking, it's questionable. Tradition 7, this is the short form. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And the long form, true to form, get ready. The AA groups themselves ought to be fully supported by the voluntary contributions of their own members. We think that each group should soon achieve this ideal, that any public solicitation of funds using the name of Alcoholics Anonymous is highly dangerous, whether by groups, clubs, hospitals, or other outside agencies, that acceptance of large gifts from any source or of contributions carrying any obligation, whatever, is unwise. Then, too, we view with much concern those AA treasuries which continue beyond prudent reserves to accumulate funds for no stated AA purpose. Experience has often warned us that nothing can so surely destroy our spiritual heritage as futile disputes over property, money, and authority. So it sounds a lot more complicated than what it actually is. Essentially what it is we're self-supporting. You know what I mean? We cover our expenses through the voluntary contributions of our members and our attendees that come to AA. And one thing I'll point out, and it's in our preamble, and it's actually in this tradition, it says a voluntary contribution. The reason why, let me backtrack. The reason why we have our members cover our expenses is because, you know, there's no such thing as giving money with no strings attached. You know, people who pay the bills are going to have some kind of say in how we conduct our affairs, and we want the ability to say what we do, how we run our meetings. Some of this stuff doesn't make sense. So when I was 9 months sober. It was like 2000 and I don't know. When did I get sober? I was 21 years old. I was a senior in high school. Nope, senior in college, right? Scary. That could have been very true. Senior in college, and I was about a year, I was just shy of 2 years sober, and my dad rolled up and with a cell phone, and cell phones were not that popular. It was an enormous flip phone. And he said, here's a cell phone. I'm going to pay for it. It's for emergency purposes only. When you're in the city, if you get stuck, call me. I'll come and get you. I was like, that's very nice. And then for the next month, I proceeded to call everyone to tell them that I had a cell phone for emergency purposes. And at the end of that month, he called me with the bill. And I got screamed at like I don't even remember. I deserved every second of it because there was no unlimited text and talk back then. And that bill was ginormous. And he just screamed at me, and then he took the cell phone away. And essentially, that's what we're trying to avoid here, you know. Right? Someone pays our way. They tell us what to do. We don't listen. They take our money away. How many people have their parents paying their rent? You know, what happens if they stop? Right? So I have to behave. My parents paid my rent for the first few years of my sobriety, and I had to behave. So essentially, that's what we're trying to do. The great thing about AA is that what I talked about earlier is that it's a voluntary contribution. You can come here and get help and not give any money. However, what I'll say is this. When I came into AA, I was broke. I drank everything, and my mom was paying bills directly at this point. It wasn't even passing through me. But what I was taught very early on, I had $19 in my bank account. How annoying is $19 in your bank account? You can't, there's nothing you can do except go to a teller, whatever that is. But I was taught very early on that when that basket passes, you just drop whatever you have in your pocket in there, regardless of what it is. And it's not essential. It's not because, like, my nickel or my quarter is going to make or break AA's bank. It's because it gives me two things. It puts the responsibility for my own recovery onto me. You know, I came in with a physical allergy to alcohol. I don't feel good when I'm not drinking. And then when I drink, I launch into a spree. You know, and with that, I am hopeless. So I need Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I put something in the basket, whatever it is, it puts the responsibility back on me to take care of Alcoholics Anonymous because I need that in order for me to recover. And if AA doesn't exist, I don't exist. And so that it does that first thing. The second thing it does is it makes me feel a part of everyone else that's putting something in the basket. You know, I'm doing this thing. I'm doing it with you. You're doing it with me. We're doing this together. And all of a sudden, I'm a part of the whole thing. And eventually, my contribution increased as I made money and stuff like that. And, you know, I learned there was a talk a couple years ago where the person said that if you're sitting in this meeting and you're drinking Starbucks, you should be putting $5 in the basket. And I was like, and because I was drinking Starbucks. And it hurt, you know, and I learned a very simple thing. Some people say that you put an amount that's going to hurt. I change it and say that I'm going to put an amount in the basket that grabs my attention to put a focus that I am a part of this thing. And you know, how I do it, and this is my own personal thing, I like to have plans because then there's no, I don't have to think about it. You know, anything that I have to think about, I try to eliminate. You know, so with this group, if I'm attending a home group meeting, I put $5. If it's another group, I put $2. The reason I do that is because I can't afford $5 at every meeting. You know, but the reason that there's a split is because, and this is the second piece of the seventh tradition, and I'm flying through this, and I'm giving a very high level because it's 10 minutes, and this tradition has a lot to it, a lot of history that I encourage you to go read and learn where it came from. But the reason I do the split is because when our expenses are covered, I know the rest goes to General Service, it goes to New York Intergroup, it goes to Southeast New York and Manhattan General Service, and that's important. You know, other groups may be doing that, but they may not be, not because they're doing it on purpose, just because they may only be making enough to cover their expenses. And I need to know that anything, the rest goes all the way over to those entities, those AA service arms that provide a very necessary function to AA as a whole. You know, Bill wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, he said that those service structures, GSO, New York Intergroup, Central Office, whatever you want to call it, provide unity and efficient 12-step work. And it's a necessity for us to continue to function as groups, to continue our unity and to, you know, General Service, think about it for a second. They oversee the publication of our literature. They take care of translating the books in different languages. And all of that is we're helping more and more and more alcoholics, but their financial forecasts don't look great. You know, so it's my responsibility as an AA member who needs AA to make sure that they're getting the money that they need to function. And, you know, what is suggested and what we do here and what we've done, and I've been a treasurer at other groups too, we prepare a treasury report. We account for everything that comes in and everything that goes out and costs. Track the attendance. And the thing that does, and why it's so crucial, and it may look a little anal retentive for AA, for a bunch of alcoholics, what it does is it gives us a good understanding of what our expenses are. Because what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to cover our expenses, keep a little savings account just for unexpected costs, and then give the rest away. And when you have a treasury report with a lot of details in it, you can develop an accurate savings, what we call it a prudent reserve. You can develop an accurate amount for your prudent reserve so that you can give an appropriate amount to the other areas in Alcoholics Anonymous and make sure that we're not giving too much or, more importantly, we're not giving too little. And so what was interesting, I heard this speaker a couple of years ago, and it was just a thought, and it was very interesting to me, that what's great about New York is that we have lots and lots of meetings all day, every day, and they're more than once at one time, and they're all over the place. But with every meeting, you have a rent. With every meeting, you have an expense. You know, and the more meetings you have, the attendees get spread out amongst all those meetings. So if you think about it, you have one meeting that has 50 attendees. Another meeting opens up a couple of blocks away at a time later in the day. You know, and now the meeting that had 50 attendees now has 30. Right? And so that one meeting was collecting a certain amount, giving the rest up. But now their attendance has dropped. So now they're only collecting a little bit and can only cover the expenses. And that's what's starting to affect New York Intergroup and General Service contributions, is that spread out thing. And I learned that after I started another meeting downtown with a bunch of people. You know, and when I think about that experience, it was a great experience, but it pulled some attendees away from another meeting. And so it's something that when meetings fold, I don't necessarily get that upset because it may be AA right-sizing itself. Because the one-liner in this tradition is where spirituality and money meet. And it's important because if we can't cover our expenses, we don't have a meeting. If we don't pay our rent, we're not meeting here. You know, it's basic, simple stuff like that. And that's why it becomes, it's not a requirement to give money, but it becomes my responsibility to give my money. So that's it. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Matt.
Hi, I'm Matt. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 14th, 2015. Atlanta Group is my home group. I have a sponsor, Adam B., and I'm currently on step 12. What that means is that I have just a few more pages to read in the chapter Working with Others with my sponsor. I don't want to talk too much about my childhood and young years because that's not why I drink. I drink because I'm an alcoholic. And there is no why. And I spent a lot of time in therapy and all of that sort of thing trying to figure out the why. You know, is it because I was adopted? Is it because, you know, I had repressed gay feelings from being in middle school and senior, you know, in senior high and all of this? And I spent too much time thinking about those things, and none of that helped to solve the problem. But I will tell you a little bit about myself in case anybody here can identify and that help you. I started drinking in high school, and I drank because it worked at the time. It made me feel brave. It made me feel good. It took away all of the things that I felt uncomfortable about myself. And so that's why, you know, I think a lot of us drink or start drinking is because it helps. It does work in the beginning. But by the time I made it to college, it was no longer working. I was drinking too much. My sophomore year, I joined a fraternity. I don't know why. And we were all just talking one day and somebody said, you know, who do you think is the worst drinker? And they said, me. And I said, you know, that's a really bad sign if a fraternity of guys is saying that you're the worst drinker. So that was the first clue. You know, I did well in college. I got an amazing internship. Everything was going the way it was supposed to. But again, there was nothing that happened to me. I just started drinking too much. And it became unbearable. I can't tell you why that happened. By my junior year in college, I had been drinking for so many days, I don't remember. And I went on WebMD and I looked up alcohol withdrawal because I was, you know, dry heaving and shaking. And I read it and it was like one of the few times that WebMD was right. And I was like, oh my God, I think I have this. And it was like, this is fatal. You need to go to the hospital. And so I went to the hospital and they were like, yeah, this is what you have. And they, you know, pretty much strapped me down and IV in and, you know, they pump you full of sedative. And, you know, I don't really remember the couple days after that. I wish I could tell you that was the last time that happened. I dropped out of college, moved back in with my parents, went to rehab, Karen Foundation. I think a lot of people know or have been there. I went to a halfway house after that. I didn't like the way they treated me, so I drank to punish them. And I ended up moving back in with my parents again. They had no idea what to do with me, but I did start going to meetings because that was one thing that a 12-step rehab teaches you is go to meetings. And I did, and I had no job. And so for 6 months, I went to meetings every day, mostly to please my parents, but I did. And for 6 months, I stayed sober. And then the only job I could get was working in a collection center from noon to 9 p.m. It's the worst job ever. And there were no meetings where I grew up after 9 p.m. And within 1 month of getting that job, I started drinking again because I couldn't get to meetings. I could have gotten up early and gone to meetings, but I didn't. And from there, it was on and off. I could hold it down. I would be a responsible drinker. I would drink scotch out of a nice glass. And then there were months where I would be chugging a bottle of wine as quick as possible. You know, and I had a whole routine, as we do, of stopping at the liquor store and this, and, you know, a whole schedule, a whole plan. And I ended up going to rehab again. I went to a non-12-step rehab. I drank the day I got out. So that tells you. And I was absolutely hopeless, but somehow I was able to hold it together, and I went and lived with my brother in California to try to, you know, get a life together, and that didn't work. I was able to save enough money. I was dry, as we say, but I was a miserable jerk. And I saved up enough money. I was working at a bank, and I did another, you know, a geographic and moved to New York City in 2014. And I thought, man, this is going to be it. I'm going to make something of myself now. And I drank the month I got here, and I couldn't find a job, and my money ran out. My parents started paying my rent. I went to see a career counselor because I thought that would help me get a job. And I walked into this appointment. She looked at my resume. She looked at, you know, the questionnaire I had filled out, and she said, you know, what's going on here? There's some sort of gap. What's happening? And I call this a God moment because for some reason I was honest with her and said, it's because I'm an alcoholic, and that's why there's all these gaps. And at the end of the appointment, she closed her folder and said, I've been sober 28 years, and you need to get to a meeting right now. And that's a miracle. And she said, can I give your phone number to somebody and have them call you? I said, yes. They called me. They took me to my first meeting and introduced me to my sponsor, Adam B. And and that's where it began, here. I lied to him for a long time, for a couple weeks. I'm sure he remembers. I restarted my day count, as I said, on January 14th of 2015 because it was something I needed to do. There were other things involved in my life that are outside of this particular room, but it was important for me to do that. And I started working the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to find a higher power, something that's greater than myself. My sponsor helped me do that. I started praying by saying, please keep me sober, and thank you for keeping me sober in the evening. I wrote down my resentments, and I shared them with my sponsor, and he listened for a couple hours and didn't make me feel bad about it. I made a list of people I harmed, and I made amends to them. I made amends to my parents. It was really beautiful. I don't know if you remember, there was this blood moon a couple months ago. I think it might have been a year ago. And it was that night, and you could see this red moon in the sky. And I made my amends to them, and they said, we love you. Now go live your life. And that was really freeing to hear that. They said, put it behind you. That was what they said. Put this all behind you and stop. Stop dwelling in the past. Go live your life. And I did. And today I have so many friends. I have an absolutely amazing life. I look around this room and I see people I know and I can smile at and say hello to. And I was petrified and shaking when I came in here. And that's, you know, what makes this place so amazing, this group especially, to be up here and in front of this microphone is really something that's really powerful. I will say this, I was, when I started going to meetings in Pennsylvania, I thought these people are nuts. People say, I have 35 years, I come every day, and I would have panic attacks like, oh my God, the only way I can stay sober is going to a meeting every day for 35 years. And that petrified me. And I was coming back in a cab from the airport the other day, and I had that thought again. This was on Saturday. Oh my God, this is nuts. Like, this is crazy to go to a meeting all the time, to write out these resentments, to do all of this. It's insane. I can't believe I'm doing this. And I'm in a cab coming back from Athens, Greece. I had previously been in Nairobi, Kenya. Before that, I was in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Before that, I was in Beirut, Lebanon, because I have a job now where I travel the world and try to help people. And that's the life I have now. And I'm in a cab questioning the thing that gave me that life and the people who gave me that life that I have today and that I made it out. But the only way I'm going to stay out is by coming here and being with all of you and sharing about it and calling my sponsor and doing all of the things that I'm told to do. So I love you all. Thanks for having me up here.